Good morning. I'd like to save 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Yes, sir.
My name is Addison Barnhart. I represent the appellant Michael Currier. This is a case that's primarily about double jeopardy. There are two trials stemming from the facts that basically a home was broken into, a safe was stolen from a home, and guns and money were located in the safe. Now, Mr. Currier was accused of this crime, and because he had committed a felony about a decade before, he was also charged with possession of a firearm by a convicted felon. And with this charge, the case had to be split into two, or else it would violate well-established case law. So we had two trials. The first trial, Mr. Currier was found not guilty of burglary and grand larceny. And significantly, in that trial, Mr. Currier presented no evidence and didn't testify. After the first trial, Mr. Currier made a motion to exclude evidence that he broke into a home and stole anything from that home. And he made the evidence based on double jeopardy, which is what I'll be calling mostly collateral estoppel, and also based on, if you introduce that evidence, it's just too prejudicial for a jury to hear.
Was the burglary charge and the grand larceny charge a judge trial or a jury trial?
It's a jury trial.
Which takes me to my next question. In the context of a jury trial, obviously the judge is going to instruct the jury as to what the elements of the case are. And if the jury will naturally be instructed, if the Commonwealth fails to prove one or more of those elements, then your obligation is to find the defendant not guilty. That's the typical instruction. Usually hear that in every case. Right? With it being a jury trial, how do we know what element the Commonwealth failed to prove in the case to justify a finding of guilt? And if, assuming for the sake of discussion, they did not prove a particular element of the case, and that was indeed the justification for a finding of not guilty, why would that necessarily preclude the facts and circumstances relating to the firearm charge being brought up?
Judge, that's a good question. It was a general verdict, so we don't know. All we have is a jury, the foreman checking a box saying not guilty. But in this case, because that's where the significance that the defendant presented no evidence and there's no disputed evidence in this case. And really, it comes down to the matter of, was the defendant present at the time that these or involved in these crimes or not? And that was the issue. You have the attorney for the Commonwealth in closing argument says exactly that, telling the jury, this case only comes down to whether or not you believe he was there and involved in the concert of action with the man who admitted to doing these crimes and was found guilty already.
I'm not suggesting that you're doing this. I'm going to use a word that sounds bad, but not directly. Doesn't that create an anomaly where the statutes and case law basically say you cannot try these two cases together? So once the Commonwealth tries the one case, and if they lose, then your argument would be that they're precluded from ever trying the second case. Is that what the legislature intended?
No, Your Honor. Well, that's actually not what I'm arguing. What I'm arguing in this case is that the circuit court judge is required to review the evidence and to review the record to see if the issue is precluded in the second trial. And there's plenty of cases at all levels of courts where the court does review the evidence and says, we can't really tell what happened from what the first jury decided. So we're going to allow everything from the first trial into the second trial, but that's that stage of review that was missing in this case. If we were to go with what the circuit court judge in Albemarle did, it would always allow a dry run for a first trial. So the Commonwealth, every time that there were two cases separated, like you just described, the first case would be a freebie every single time. And I don't think that's a clear violation of double jeopardy. I think double jeopardy requires at least a review to say, if you had a not guilty verdict in the beginning, what was the meaning of that before we go on to the next trial?
But bringing up the facts and circumstances regarding the burglary case and the second trial doesn't expose your client to any criminal liability for what happened in the first trial. And isn't that what double jeopardy is all about?
Well, as the facts show in this case, it was all part and parcel of the same thing. The firearm, so he was found not guilty of stealing firearms, but then found guilty of possessing the firearms that were stolen. And there is no break, and there's no time difference or any other facts that aren't involved in the possession of the firearms that didn't have that did not involve the stealing. Basically, the evidence came out in the second trial that after they stole the safe, they tried to open the safe. The person who pled guilty is Bradley Wood, and he claims he had accomplices. But and basically, when the safe was opened,
he had to have, right? I mean, unless he's home
yes.
or something.
He had to have accomplices. That's right. Yes, sir.
Steal a gun safe of that size.
It was a very large safe. But basically, when the safe was opened, it was a surprise to everyone that there were guns in there. And there's no evidence of any prior knowledge that there were guns. That there wasn't any intent to steal guns. It was all. So I think it was a complete surprise. And because you have that and the unique facts of this case, you can't separate it out from the breaking and entering and burglary. So if you have this case of a possession of a firearm, there's no way to have it without saying that Mr. Currier was involved in stealing and involved in a home invasion.
But getting back to something Judge McCullough talked about indirectly, doesn't it get down to dominion and control? Let me give you an example. Suppose we have a situation where someone steals a safe, and they're stealing the safe because they think that there might be money or valuables in the safe. And they steal the safe, and they crack the safe open, and then there's 100,000 pounds of cocaine. I'm making that up to make it even more ridiculous. 100,000 pounds of cocaine. And just as they crack the safe open and see the 100,000 pounds of cocaine, the police are at the top of the hill. They come down and they say, well, we thought there was money and guns. We thought there was money in there and jewelry. We had no idea that there was cocaine. So you can't charge us with that because we didn't know that there was cocaine in the safe. Would that be correct?
I think dominion and control would be an issue there, and perhaps knowledge would be an arguable point so that you could separate the possession aspect there, but that's not what happened in this case where all of a sudden police officers were there when the safe was opened. In fact, the safe was dumped in a river with all of the firearms still in it. Mm-hmm. And then it was 6 months later that Mr. Currier was arrested. So in terms of the dominion and control and the possession, those were all, you just can't get to any of those without saying that they had stolen a safe and they were opening it to take the loot out for what they could find.
Counsel,
and doesn't that conclusively undermine your second assignment of error? I know your primary submission is the double jeopardy / collateral estoppel argument, but if you can't get to the possession of guns without the contextual background, then why is it an abuse of discretion for the court to give that background into evidence?
I see the point. I think the main thing I would have to say to that is because of the prejudicial nature of the evidence that came in, the evidence that the Commonwealth used to describe the burglary and the theft, that there were victims and that there was a manhunt for somebody, and all of this creates an irrational inference, basically, that because there was a break-in, that the client had to be involved in that, and so you get this weight of the evidence that doesn't really have to do with the physical possession of a gun, that all has to do mostly with the breaking and entering. And I think that that's where the jury is going to be looking at all that and thinking that's what we're ruling on, and not on the possession of the firearm.
Were both of these bench trials?
They were both jury trials, Your Honor.
Both jury trials. And in the second trial, was there evidence about the Commonwealth's argument in the first case, because you mentioned that in response to, I believe it was Judge Alston's question, that the Commonwealth solely argued the presence or lack thereof of the defendant.
That was also the case. It was solely an issue of presence in the second case as well. There was no other testimony given by the defense. And in neither trial, the defense produced no evidence. So it was solely, could the Commonwealth produce enough evidence beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendant was involved in the first trial with the burglary and the larceny? The second trial, they talked about the burglary and larceny in order to get to then he possessed the gun when the safe was opened, and that was it. Have I answered your question?
Well, I believe that you have. I think there was a question raised in the briefs about whether or not the record was adequate on what occurred in the first trial on this issue of whether on the issue that in the first trial it was whether or not the defendant was present?
Well, I think that the record, what you have in the record before you is the closing arguments and I think all of the testimony from the first trial. And that the record's adequate to show what happened there with that regard.
Was there an adjudicated acts instruction provided?
An adjudicated acts?
Yes.
I don't believe so, Your Honor. And I'm not exactly sure what it
would. Well, what I would call an adjudicated acts instruction, if I were counsel, I might consider saying, that's proposing to the judge who's hearing the jury trial, Judge, you know, we have a situation. I'm maintaining my position with regard to double jeopardy. But notwithstanding that, I think that there should be a cautionary instruction regarding the Commonwealth's use of this evidence and the fact that my client was adjudicated not guilty of this offense. You know, something.
That argument was made. It wasn't assigned as error in this case, but we, after arguing the the evidence should be prevented because it's too prejudicial, we also argued that the jury should at least know that the defendant was acquitted of the breaking and entering and larceny, and the judge overruled.
But there was no crafting of instruction and said, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, you've heard background evidence as how the defendant may have come into this evidence. You're instructed to consider that only and for context. You're also instructed that that case was adjudicated. The defendant was found not guilty of that offense, and so you're only to use this and use that information for this limited purpose, something like that. You probably have to work hard to draft it, but it would seem to me that it would be something that you'd like to at least propose as a secondary basis for consideration.
To answer the first question, no, there wasn't an instruction like that. And with pretrial motions, everything that I could think of personally, I tried to do to prevent the evidence. But the judge and the circuit court
seemed... I don't think anybody can fault the vigor of the advocacy.
Thank you, Your Honor. the judge wanted it to come in, and that seemed pretty clear. Though it wasn't argued on... for jury instructions.
Isn't this conceptually different from the Ash versus Swenson, where you had a bunch of folks around a gaming table, say, try victim number one, doesn't work out, go victim number two, see if that takes, and presumably if that didn't work, we just work our way around the table until we can convict the defendant, as opposed to this case, which is for the benefit of the defendant now. We're going to peel off some of these cases, or one of these cases, and to avoid prejudice to him, we're going to have separate trials. So at least the lead up to the prosecution is a little different than what we saw in Ash. Does that make any difference?
You're right, Your Honor, that it is different with the Ash. But that's exactly what the Albemarle Circuit Court decided, that there would be some sort of prejudice to the Commonwealth, because the trials had to be separated, it was to the benefit of the defendant. But I would argue that it's really not to the benefit of the defendant that the felony is not in the first case. The felony could be brought in for impeachment purposes. I mean, I think that's one of the reasons that he's not testifying. But it's really for the benefit of the jury, so they're focusing on the issues rather than the benefit of the defendant. It's just a rule of evidence that's got to be followed.
You're into your rebuttal down, counsel. You can continue if you like, but just want to put you on notice.
I'll save whatever time I have left, but what I want to be clear that we're asking the court to reverse the trial court in Albemarle and to dismiss these charges, and that was an issue raised in the...
You want to reverse and dismiss as opposed to reverse and
yes, right, and I believe that the court has authority to do that. When you look at the facts in the record here, because it's a de novo review of collateral estoppel, that the court has the authority to dismiss, and we'd ask you to do that.
Thank you.
Good morning, Susan Baumgartner for the Commonwealth. I would like to start on that last point, which is that dismissal was not requested in the briefs. Dismissal was not part of the assignment of error.
That is the typical remedy if there's a double jeopardy problem.
It is the typical remedy, but it was not what was requested. What was requested was a retrial without the evidence of breaking and entering and grand larceny. Now, there are two reasons why collateral estoppel does not apply in this case. The first one being that there was no prior proceeding, as it's meant within collateral estoppel. And the second being that the defendant has not met his burden of establishing that the proper factual issue was decided.
With double jeopardy, I mean, the Supreme Court kind of can't seem to agree on a theory for why we have the clause. mean, they articulate over time all these different reasons, but one of them that they have mentioned is, as the case is put, the defendant doesn't have to run the gauntlet multiple times. So that's one of its purposes. So consistent with that, why should we take this technical approach? Well, technically it started as one indictment, one group batch of indictments, and but we're going to parse out whether this, because there clearly were separate trials, and he has to run the gauntlet multiple times. Why doesn't that resolve the case against the Commonwealth?
Because due to Hackney and the procedure that Virginia chooses to follow in felon in possession cases, there is no possibility of trying those cases together. And every single defendant then who was acquitted in his first trial would get a freebie for his felon in possession trial.
And do you agree with the characterization that Hackney is for the benefit of the jury to have them focus on, you know, avoiding distractions and extraneous issues as opposed to for the benefit of the
defendant? No, Hackney is solely for the benefit of the defendant. It is certainly not for the benefit of the prosecution who has to do two trials, or the witnesses who have to testify twice, or an extra jury that has to serve, or the court that has to make room for its on its docket. It is solely for the benefit
of the
defendant.
Is that what the case says?
I believe the case is not quite that strident, Your Honor. But it
analytically, that's what it says.
But it is practically it is for the benefit of the
defendant. Let's turn it around a little bit, and I appreciate your point that if we were to take the one example that I gave to its extreme, if you are acquitted on the burglary grand larceny charge, and that precludes prosecution on the other charge, firearm charge. What if the Commonwealth reversed, tried the firearm charge first? Would that preclude you from them going forward on the burglary charge?
I don't think so.
Okay. So why shouldn't the Commonwealth in that circumstance say, okay, if the law is indeed what your opponent colleague suggests, we need to make sure that as a matter of practice and course, we need to try the felony firearm charge first because of the risk of a double jeopardy context with regard to the grand larceny burglary charge?
Well, because I think it doesn't preclude the second prosecution for the same reason it doesn't here. The cases involve different intents. They involve some degree, certainly in this case, of different times and different locations. And therefore, it doesn't matter which one you tried first. Collateral estoppel isn't going to preclude.
So if we came up with a rule that collateral estoppel does indeed preclude the second prosecution, that it would apply whether it's felony for the firearm charge first or the burglary charge first?
I think it could, yes, because ultimately that is a factual determination.
Okay.
Regarding
I have a curiosity
yes.
question, and that is, both of these trials were in Albemarle, is that correct?
Yes.
The safe was found in Nelson?
Yes.
Could the defendant have been tried for possession of a firearm in Nelson?
I do believe he could have, but that was not the prosecutorial decision that was made. But yes, there was evidence that he possessed it from Albemarle into Nelson.
Okay.
I don't think that precludes, though, him having been tried in Albemarle as well. While the defense has argued that there was no break, no time difference, no new evidence, there was some very important new evidence that was allowed into the firearm in possession case that was not in the burglary case, and that was the DNA. The defendant's DNA was found in the truck bed with the safe insulation materials, which proved that he was present and connected to the opening of the safe. Whether or not he was involved with actually removing the safe from the home.
So theoretically, again, just theoretically, he could have been an accessory after the fact or whatever with regard to the guns and had no involvement whatsoever with the burglary and the larceny.
That's correct. Or he could have had an involvement with the burglary and the larceny, but not had the intent to steal and not had the intent to break and enter. There was evidence that the back door was broken into and the front door was just locked. This was the accomplice's uncle's house. He could have just opened the door and said to the defendant, come on in and help me move my uncle's safe. And he could have only found out later that this was a crime.
Receiving that information or that welcome from a person in apparent authority to offer that welcome.
Correct. And without that intent to steal, the first jury couldn't have convicted of the burglary or the grand larceny. Now, we don't have in front of us the instructions given to the first jury, and I think that does put this court at a disadvantage because the defendant has not presented
the
remedy
that by issuing us a cert order to the circuit court.
Correct. However, I do believe it was the defendant's burden to do so because he had to demonstrate to this court that it was necessarily decided. And it simply wasn't whether or not the defendant was present. Presence is not sufficient to convict of burglary or grand larceny. There also has to be the concert of action, and that's when it gets into the intent. Furthermore, there's a great deal of case law, which I cited in my brief, about why when we're dealing with collateral estoppel and we're dealing about this sort of case, the prior proceeding means when the Commonwealth, when the prosecution chooses to start one set of charges, finish them, and then start again, as opposed to, in this case, when original jeopardy never terminated and that this was not the Commonwealth's choice. This was a matter of law to protect the defendant.
Do you see this issue, as the Commonwealth would see it, as a case of which would require a published opinion?
I don't, because I don't find this case particularly different from Rice. Rice was two simultaneous trials. The felon in possession was a bench trial that was happening at the same time the jury was hearing the other charges. However, even in Rice, the court accepted the jury's verdict, then heard the additional evidence for the felon in possession, and then convicted. So I don't think there's a significant difference given that the acquittal was accepted by the court before additional evidence was heard, whether or not that additional evidence was heard on another day. If there are no further questions, I ask you to affirm.
Thank you, ma'am.
Your Honors, what the defendant is asking for is for the circuit court to review the evidence and to make a determination under the Ash standard. That was not done in this case. The court created its own standard at the end, but basically followed Rice to get around even making the Ash standard. So when we say collateral estoppel applies, I would argue that collateral estoppel always applies, as the Constitution always applies. In this case, they use a procedural argument. The judge, I think, uses the Commonwealth's procedural argument to not apply that standard. When you apply the standard, collateral estoppel can apply or cannot apply. And we have cases, about half the cases it doesn't apply and half the cases it does. It depends on the facts and circumstances of the case. So to have a case or to create a law that collateral estoppel, there is simply no review, no double jeopardy review, I think is a standard that is against double jeopardy and is certainly against what Ash says in terms of preventing a dry run or preventing the defendant from having to run the gauntlet twice. The defendant did have to run the gauntlet twice in this case. There was a six-month separation between the trials, and most of the same, almost all of the same evidence, including additional evidence, was used in the second case to get a conviction, where in the first case it wasn't. It didn't happen.
All right, counsel. Thank you. The matter is submitted. We'll come down and greet counsel.